Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 25th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Katie Hogan, continuing her series, Chop Wood, Carry Water, Spiritual Use of Everyday Tasks. Today's title is The Transformation of Work, Redefining Our Goals at Work to Serve Our Goals of Life. Let's listen in.
This is a really cozy group. We should probably be in a smaller room, really. John DeGraff's movie, did anybody just watch it? No. That's... Great. Where'd you go?
Well, partway up to the guided tour towards 10 Mile.
Ah, very good.
She didn't quite make it. She was getting a little sore.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of boring for her.
Right. Yeah, they wonder, what's the big deal? Walking through a forest. It's like, that's the big deal right there.
So you were at the movie?
I was, until I pulled away to sort of collect my thoughts for this. And I thought we'd have a pretty low session, both because it's first dinner time and because practically the entire camp was watching Affluenza. Which is interesting because I gave a reading yesterday in my class. There's a couple copies left of most of the stuff I've passed out this week. And there's one other thing that isn't there, and all of it is on reserve in the library if you wanted to look at it further. But you can take anything that's here today. Anyway, the article that I gave out yesterday has so much of the start of it is really just exactly what we just watched on his Affluenza documentary about consumerism and the mentality of for-profit efficiency, which is so interesting. As I've taught politics and government, a lot of folks think that for-profit, and it's even developed into a political mantra for certain candidates and whatever, that for-profit is where efficiency is not-for-profit and government is inefficiency. And it's not true, as it turns out. There's studies that back it up now. Of course, there's history and truth to the fact that the Army bought, you know, $70 hammers, you know, for years when they could have bought $1.50 or whatever. And there's lots and lots of historical proof of certain government agencies overspending or blowing money in one way or another, whether it's on people's salaries or materials or programs that basically, you know, any of us could have said, yes, we do believe that hard work causes people to be sleepy, whereas the government might back a study of $700,000 worth of work to find that sort of thing out. But on a more recent level in certain government agencies around the country, there have been studies done about their quote-unquote efficiency, and in terms of doing more with less, given that the government, the federal government has moved lots of jobs that it used to do to the state and local level in the last 10 years. Local governments, they got the jobs to do it. They received orders to do this work, but they didn't necessarily get the funds to go with it. So what has happened, and I shouldn't start out, this is not part of the class that I intended, but anyway, I should probably gather some page of figures about this, because for-profit efficiency is something of a myth at this point in time. And also, so is the welfare state and how much money we've saved by kicking, you know, mothers with many children off welfare when we haven't kicked the real welfare cheats off welfare, which is corporate welfare recipients. Anyway, for this week, there's at least two new people here, maybe three. For this week, we've been talking about work and spiritual unity inside of ourselves as we work, or in spite of our work, and where, in fact, does work in our lives fall? Is it central? Is it a motivating? Is it a service to our spiritual calling? Or is it something that is an obstacle to that and something that we just put in time and when it's over, then we can turn into ourselves? So towards that, I talked a lot about having set up a restaurant in Chicago 24 years ago, which is, you know, miraculously still exists and runs as I speak. Knock on wood. I'll be home in a couple days to find out. With some 50 employees and a track record of really having, in pretty short order, become a neighborhood institution and something even beyond that. There are people here I've run into who know of the Heartland from their travels east, as they put it. Chicago's east. Blows my mind. I mean, it's just so funny. Okay, fine. You guys have heard of New York, right? Anyway, so we talked about, I mean, I talked about the Heartland and what I felt I was beginning to experience as a result of doing small business, doing it without a huge or possibly any profit motive, also doing it on the basis of what it could give back to the community and how, in fact, we must plan to give back to the community from day one in our way of thought, or the business itself wouldn't be what we set out to do. We set out to make a place that was inviting to all types of people, that did not have an exclusionary feel to it, that offered a really quality product for a reasonable price, that also provided a better than, more positive than normally encountered work experience in that industry for the employees. Final goal was to provide a community center of sorts where people could come and get information on causes, issues, political concerns that we had, stuff that we felt were important, was important information to share. All of those things happened, and as I told the first group's class, hello, welcome, Mark. You know, we didn't put one of our goals as being make money. And I would not advise that to anybody anymore. You know, I'm talking to students, and I often have been when I do the shop wood carry water thing, I say, please feel free to add make money as a goal in the list of goals that you have in your business, because it's not like we, you know, we stayed open, thank God, but it was tricky, and it took a lot of heart and a lot of lean months and times to get through, because the restaurant business is a very hard business to make money in anyway. So anyway, from there we talked a little bit about social action. From there we also had some Holden villagers, some long-term staff people, form a panel and talk with us on Wednesday, I think that was, which I thought was a great back and forth. Lots of folks who had either worked a little or a lot at Holden talked about the meaning of their work and shared a great deal, I thought. I've got lots of wonderful insights that were shared at that session. And then yesterday, I injected, because for me, it's part of my work, part of my feel for of calling or mission is something around creating a more democratic situation in the world, starting with the village right around me. And whether or not it gets further it's anybody's guess, and there are moments, there have been times when we've been all of us working on something that was clearly affecting something on the other side of the world. But more and more, as you know, we've gotten older, and since our initial activism around ending a war half a world away, almost everything is local. And so if you make and take a stand locally, it does have an impact. And so another thing that we've talked about is the interdependence that is sort of resting at the bottom of the concept of making a right livelihood, choosing to do your work in a Buddhist-centered kind of notion, that it's that it's a path to your own enlightenment if you choose right livelihood, that does not harm any sentient being. So this is sort of a little bit of a wrap up of what has gone before. And then I gave out some articles that brought us back after yesterday's conversation, where I basically shared a lot of political anecdotes from Chicago politics and from having helped run a couple of mayoral campaigns for the late Mayor Harold Washington, which was fun for me. I don't know if it was what other people expected, but a few people said they didn't mind hearing about that sort of thing. But social action as an offshoot of your livelihood, whether or not it's part of what you get paid for, or if it's something that you're allowed to do while you work, or sort of in tangent. Lots of teachers I know feel that they do the work of the Lord, or the work of their heart, when they teach, and when they are allowing for kids to be, for example, protected from what we just saw in this film, which was the invasion of classroom space by advertisement, which was just incredible. No one here watched that film just now, right? You did. Yeah, that was incredible. Textbooks that include, you know, the history of Tootsie Roll, for example, as part of World War II's history. Stuff that, you know, adults don't even know their kids are seeing in a lot of ways. Okay, so, you know, what we did touch on, and I would love to hear from people who are here, if they're not feeling too shy, both about your work that you do and to what extent it serves you, the hungry soul of you, and to the extent that it doesn't, how you make up for that. Do you cut your work hours, or do you just intensify what you do with the hours that you are freed up from the dollar wage time of your day? Or do you have the great situation of working what you love, doing what you love? And I know we've got some Holden staff here, as well as Holden guests. And maybe since we are such a small group, maybe we could just, I would like to, I'll move closer to you guys. That's what I'll do.
I know. Go for it,
too. Yeah, I don't know why. But I'll do that, like that. I don't know what that is out there. So, who wants to introduce themselves? Anybody?
Well,
I'm
Mary, for one thing. We're two Marys that are friends that came together. But I'm a nurse myself, and I've been working part-time since my children were born, and that's about 20 years ago. So I think the part-time has really been a big help for me, because I haven't worked full-time since before they were when my son was born, is when I started, and mm-hmm. I've always enjoyed it. It is, I guess, a service kind of a oriented profession, and I've always just enjoyed just visiting with people and you know, while you're caring for them, and you can relate, you know, like a lot of people are other parents, or, you know, women kind of things, or whatever, you know, just people kind of things. You can just joke, and, you know, I've always just tried to be really just myself around the patients, and I think that they've appreciated that. You just, here we are, you happen to be sick, and I'm taking care of you, and, you know, it seems to be kind of a fun way to approach the other part of it is certainly what they're there for, but, and what I'm there for, but, I mean, you don't have to fully focus on that, so. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy it. It's, you know, it's kind of good. But I think for me, the part-time, I was just fortunate I didn't have to work full.
Do you work in a hospital that is a private hospital, or mm-hmm. is it church related?
No, it's the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. So it's not at all. Although there's chaplains, and, you know, you can call mm-hmm. ministers to come, and they do come through, but it's not a, like the Sisters of Providence or something like that.
Okay. Well, I have lots of questions, but I'll wait till everybody gets introduced and talks about where their job and where their heart, heart's desire is actually located, whether it's with their job or not. So another Mary, huh?
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. I too am a nurse, and I work in the home health area, mm-hmm. which I go out to people's homes and help them in brief visits. Now, this is not private duty nursing.
Mm.
So I spend up to 2 hours in the home, usually 30 minutes or so. We do a lot of teaching and a lot of initial assessments with people coming home from the hospital and having certain problems and having to work through medications, for example, with what they have in the home and what's been ordered for them, straightening out things, figuring out how to teach them to do their own care. Does that give you an idea
of
what I do?
Sure.
And that's extremely satisfying. And for the best part about it is going to homes in the central part of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel when I go home to my suburban place way up north that I've been in another world. And I just love that. However, to do that, I no longer do that because I'd have to drive too far. I'd have to drive like 110 miles a day, and that's not doable.
Mm-hmm.
So I work in an area fairly near to my home, and that's fine. That's good, but there's not the satisfaction of central Seattle.
What was the heart of that satisfaction?
People really needed you,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of times they didn't have a lot of other social support. I mean, that was it.
That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You were supplying.
However, I must add that I only work a day and a half a week. The paperwork is overwhelming, and I think. Well, I have a young son too, not that young. I've just been able to get by with working a day and a half a week. But I, anyway, that's how I solve the problem of being overwhelmed and still
keep
not
yourself
work very
from
much.
Being overwhelmed. Yeah. Right. Well, thank you for sharing that. How about you?
I'm Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned I'm also a nurse. I keep sitting next to you, too.
Wow, that's amazing.
There's something there.
No, we like to get you were here this morning at Bible study.
Yeah.
I know. Sitting in a row.
But I have a different experience with nursing, and I think I was a misfit. I went in partly because I flipped my coin, and I wanted to stay at the school I was at and follow in the footsteps of my mom.
What's on the other side of the coin, man?
Oh, maybe physical therapy.
Oh, close enough.
Close okay. enough. And I think I would have been more
as long as it wasn't
there.
Engineering or nursing.
No.
You know?
But I went in there, and I enjoyed nursing. And I did general, mostly medicine, for a couple of years. And the part I liked most was just the talking with people and the contact there. Then I ended up meeting my husband, and we went back to the Midwest for his residency, and I got into high power medical intensive care.
Mm.
Real intense stuff, and I struggled with a lot of ethical issues of keeping people alive.
Mm.
The struggle too, appropriately, but also inappropriately, and this constant change of residents and different methods of they're learning, and so there's a real push to do everything you can. And I would look at some patients and say, let them go. Or dealing with 16-year-olds, and they're dying before your eyes. And it was a real heavy emotional time for me.
Hmm.
But I also got peeks into what really gave me life, and that was almost working, doing grief work with parents. And kind of assist working on that spiritual side of it, of helping people learn to start the process of letting go.
Hmm.
And so when we came back to Wenatchee, did a little bit of office work, which I thought was a whole different kind, and it was a different context, but I was really burned out on nursing by then. And so had the opportunity to start raising a family, and did 10 years of discernment, and I'm going back to school now, where I think I'm feeling the heart going in ministerial type, maybe spiritual direction, if I can call myself enough. I don't know if I'm a good fit for that, but what I'd like is retreats, and I like the idea of ritual formation, because I've seen the lack of that for particularly young people. I was just reading in here and finally getting to the confirmation, rites of passage.
Yes.
Right. I just see that as an area that's lacking, and people are kind of way behind in the development. I mean, I've been waiting for this. This is the part of the meat I'm looking for.
Yes, good.
So that's where I'm moving.
There might be a couple that you didn't get yesterday.
Yeah,
too, so.
Yeah, I'll check. So that's kind of where I'm at.
That's great. Spiritual director, huh?
It's a Master of Arts in Transforming Spirituality, which is kind of a strange title for a Lutheran. But
where do you get that?
I'm going to Seattle University, which is a Jesuit school, so I'm getting a lot of ecumenical stuff, too.
Great.
It's been really nice.
We have that in common. I'm going to Loyola in Chicago, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been over to Loyola.
In Chicago?
Yeah.
Oh.
I've been a part of Native American Lutheran ministry. We've been on the college many times. That was one of the two universities we decided to use as a meeting place.
Yeah. Well, if we could just
start, Mark.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark. We're just talking about what we do and how it serves.
Well, three of my major occupations were, in a sense, wanting to do, in a sense, service work with our native people.
Mm-hmm.
My first graduating, I ended up had a fisheries and forestry management degree, and I ended up thought I could work with our tribes in helping with mainly fisheries, because they ended up our Northwest, our fisheries people, and I ended up that was more of a burnout, mainly because of, I think, the bureaucracy of dealing with state and federal and both commercial sport and all the fisheries, and
sure.
Let alone just trying to deal with the individual tribes who had their individual agendas.
Mm-hmm.
And that only lasted 2 years, and then graduated in a MSW in social work. And thought what a better way would be working with programs with Northwest Native American Indian Health Board. And I was able to do that for 3 years down in Portland, Oregon, out of their office, but then worked out of both Olympia and in Shelton, right by my reservation.
Mm.
And was able to do that also for 3 years. And administration came into the Reagan administration, and they ended up axed a lot of the social programs.
Mm-hmm.
We were 3 years into a new program, and they ended up, we were the first ones to go, of course. So that was the three major transitions, and being able to get hired on at the University of Washington and teach Native American studies for the last 10 years is also a job that I work at and enjoy helping Northwest people that come to the University of Washington know who the Northwest Native American people
mm-hmm.
are. And I've been teaching that for the last 10 years. It's an enjoyment for me for being a Northwest Native American and talk about our own history and help people that want to know about our Northwest people, help them understand in a better way than where we get a lot of fallacies of people stand there, have different ideas of what American Indian are, Native American are. A number of people stand there, one of their first questions are, you know, what do we call ourselves? And I normally tell them, well, I call myself Mark.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, just giving them a bad time. But depending on the different tribes, they have their different name of what they want to call themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I normally start by saying that a lot of the tribes like to be called by whatever
the tribal name
that they're called. Mm-hmm. Start with that. and then worked with Native American Ministry, and I've done that for the last 27 years. So that's actually a way of me also helping the church understand Native people. So most of my work is work that I want to do.
Sounds like it.
And I haven't done that for a long time.
So it's like a seamless whole, your life.
And it's always ongoing, you know.
What?
And it's always ongoing because they end up, I'm both helping.
Thank God for that.
ELCA.
As opposed to the alternative.
ELCA, Catholic, the Episcopal, and the Methodist.
Just hanging out with the churches.
Yeah, I help out ecumenically. Both the Washington Association of Churches, Church Council of Greater Seattle, and the Archdiocese of Olympia. Well, they call it Archdiocese of Olympia, and I think it's an Archdiocese for the Episcopals too that I work with.
Okay.
I walk in all different realms within the ecumenical work.
All right, thanks.
And I'm Don.
All right.
And, I'm staff here for a few months, and I guess I retired from my job, because I don't know what's next, but that work was 28 years in Texas for state teaching retirement system. And it was, for me, a service-oriented job. That's what I wanted to do, and it fulfilled that, or else I wouldn't have stayed there that long.
What is it? You were with the teachers' retirement system?
Mm-hmm.
So you were servicing retired teachers?
Yeah.
And their pensions and all that? Huh?
It's kind of a specialized niche there and helping people with that process as they're
leaving work.
Yeah, leaving work.
That's kind of interesting.
What benefits they're going to get.
Uh-huh.
And what do they have to do to get them. So, I work with disability applicants for the last 10 years of that, so had kind of I call it unplanned retirement, you know, they just had to do it, but
well, that's very much service work that you did.
Yeah, and it was, you know, during a day, you know, numerous people, and just, you know, at the longest, I would say, you know, an hour to 2 hours with each person. Which that variety was
good,
matches to me.
Uh-huh.
But also, I think the work environment was very important. That it was important that the relationships with other people in the workplace. We really had kind of we were a smaller agency, so it was more like a family atmosphere. I'm even more aware of it because the last few years is kind of like Mark mentioned, like the Reagan administration, the state
cuts.
Government changed, and they came in and turned everything kind of upside down and crazy. Changed the measures of everything and what we were supposed to do. So I found myself, you know, trying to keep the thing going and meet the client's needs, but getting orders to do things a certain way.
Uh-huh.
And what the orders were is very impersonal, so they were trying to get all of us that were service-oriented people to just think of numbers and...
Interesting.
You only had 3 minutes on the phone with anybody or that.
Frustrating.
Kind of stuff. Yeah, and I mean, I just discovered that I can't do that.
So did that decide you to retire maybe quicker than you would have had that change?
It burned me out. I couldn't retire. I mean, the only choice was just to quit. And I just stuck it out. And my bosses actually quit. So it was the new bosses, they quit, so it finally kind of turned back around.
Interesting.
So that's my path to this point anyway.
But you're a young man, so.
Yeah.
Here you are working at Holden, you could start a whole nother thing, right?
Exactly. And it's got to be something that it is purposeful,
mm-hmm.
and that does, is helpful,
mm-hmm.
to the community.
And to Don.
Yes, and I mean, that's my reward, is being involved in that.
Yeah.
And the interaction with the people.
I can understand that. Thanks.
My name is Renee Schaefer. I'm an associate in ministry at Lutheran Church in Issaquah. Been there almost 2.5 years now. Before that, at another Lutheran congregation. It's where I belong. I can't imagine doing anything else. That's how good it feels. Probably the biggest joy, not probably, the biggest joy I get is seeing other people grow in their discipleship, grow in their faith.
Hmm.
That's really equipping God's people for the work of ministry is at the heart of my personal ministry. So the church is a good place to live that out. And it's not to say that there aren't challenges, because there are.
Yeah.
There's disappointments. It's very hard work, but you know, God never promised it would be easy, and He just promised to be there with me. So I'm feeling very good about what I'm doing.
How long have you been doing that work, Renee?
I've been paid for it for 10 years.
We all know what that
means. Probably another 24 years. Total of 24 years.
Uh-huh.
So another 14 years, four of which were pretty much full-time volunteering.
Uh-huh.
Another 10 kind of part-time.
Do you have kids too?
Children? I have one.
Mm-hmm. Child.
Is that what you asked me?
Yep.
Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. She's grown up.
Mm-hmm. Renee, what did you call that again? Was it associate? Was it
what? Associate in ministry.
Associate in ministry.
Yeah, I'm not ordained. It's a certified.
Right.
There's a certification process to go through, but
AIM, isn't it?
Right, an AIM.
AIM. Yeah.
Oh.
It's a certified rostered position in the ELCA.
Uh huh. Being that I'm a Catholic.
Oh, okay.
I need to be I'm a little slow on the terminology, but my mother was a pastoral assistant is what they call it in Chicago. I mean, in Catholic parishes. Say what?
All the decadents be Lutheran
Catholic. Hey, it's all right. Just as long as I can stop and ask them what they mean, it's all right with me.
Well, I've been a Lutheran for over 20 years, and I just heard of it this spring.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, it's also probably more relatively recent, more recent development in great numbers. If the Lutheran Church is like our church in that lay people are doing way more, and of course your pastors can marry. That makes it a lot more inviting. Chicago, I mean, I keep saying Chicago. Catholics, no, we're in bad shape. We have fewer and fewer vocations, and so the lay people are really really required to hold up the church big right now, and has been for a while. So you are just, your life is a seamless whole. One thing flows into the next.
Not necessarily. I mean, there's some. In some ways, the church can be a lonely place.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, I'm a single person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's parts. Yeah, is my life perfect? No. No. There's always room for improvement. But as far as what I do for work, and that's a big part of my life, and I have the freedom right now, because I don't have a guy in my life. I work hard.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't do it begrudgingly. I do it rather joyfully.
That's wonderful.
I get tired. I don't think about throwing in the towel though, or quitting. So.
Well, you brought up another aspect that we haven't even talked about very much, and that is for those of us who are single, me too, you do wind up, you know, if you're living a single life and you don't have children to take care of,
yeah.
both of those things going on,
yeah.
work becomes your life.
Yeah.
It can become your life mm-hmm. if you like it, and yeah. sometimes even if you don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
If it is your major source of social interaction, and you like some of the people that you're interacting with at work, you'll be more inclined to just hang there. But I also like the way Renee said it, no guy in my life,
yeah.
meaning I can pour more energy into my work.
Yeah. Well, in some ways it can also, I mean, yes, the negative side of it is that it can be a place to hide out.
Exactly. Precisely. I've felt that lots late at night in my restaurant, in the back office.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. Let's get...
I'm Pat Duke. I live in Issaquah. I go to the same church as Renee.
Uh-huh.
And I've been a single parent since both of my children were preschoolers. They're now 20 and 23.
Uh-huh.
And I've been in the same situation. Solo parent with never any relatives or anything, living within even 100 or 200 miles, usually.
Uh-huh.
And... So when I moved to Seattle, when I was young, I was a high school English teacher, and I was, it really, really was something that clicked for me. I love high school kids.
Mm.
I love to listen to them and things like that, but I really burned myself out. I just threw myself into it so totally. That after 5 years, I left that job. I mean, it's just, there was a cell in me left, hardly, that wasn't burned out. And then I did a bunch of things for about 8 years. Eventually, after I had my second child, I ended up getting a job in information technology, a little computer company. And I've been in that field since 1982. When I moved to Seattle, I actually moved here from a smaller town in Oregon because I had a child that was single parent. I had a child with a lot of medical problems, and everybody said, you need to work for a big corporation with good insurance policy and that sort of thing. So I have not really felt like I was doing the job I'm called to do. On the other hand, I felt like I was called to take care of my children. And if having good medical benefits with a job was part of what I had to do for my children. I used to say that to my people at work. Am I supposed to be here? Am I supposed to be doing this? And they would say, but look at you, you're taking good care of your children. So,
In the course of your work there, you had people with whom you shared your life.
Oh yes. I was in management for the last 11 years, and I know I was really successful in that role. I love mm-hmm. people. I love people. I like to enable them. I like to see them grow. So that has been fine. But I finally, I read a wonderful quote after I quit my job last summer. I left the corporation, and it said, "The fates lead those who will. Those who won't, they drag." And I thought, that was you, dear. You stayed at that job too long. I was sick of it when I left. I took 6 months off and did a lot of exploring and reading and thinking and stayed in a monastery for a while and did all these things. And I really thought I'd end up a nonprofit. And one of the groups that was on the film today in Affluenza was, that's my dream place to work.
Which group was that?
It's a group called Northwest Earth Institute.
Oh, right.
In Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I have done tons of volunteer work for the last 5 years. Ever since my kids got older, instantly I was out the door, and I'm on stream teams. I do river restoration. I do lectures on the aquifers. I do, this year I did amphibian monitoring. Last year I did macroinvertebrate studies, and I mean, if it's got stuff on it,
okay, then.
I'm out there.
You are out there, Pat.
So I know that's my, I mean, maybe I'm mistaking my vocation for my work, because now I'm back in IT, my new job, I'm a project manager, though, and I figure that's a skill that will be good no matter what.
Sure.
Anywhere.
Should be.
That's the encouraging thing about that job, but I don't feel like it's a place I'm really supposed to be, but I feel like I'm getting there.
Good. That's great. Well, everybody brought up a stuff we could just go off on. I was immediately, as soon as three nurses in a row popped up, I was immediately called back to questions that I had sort of alluded to on the very first morning. You know, questions of the ethical dilemmas at work, basically. You know, and they include the power inequities. Who's got the power? How much power are you stripped of, or are you allowed to express? Since all of us are, you know, sovereign beings, and if left to our own devices in a place where we know what our job is, we can be as creative as possible. But like Don said, you know, with the change of administrations, he got told, no, back off, robotize your encounters with the people. And we all know that can happen. Work, that's one of the great diminishing aspects of work. But the other thing that I had, the questions of power and honesty, you know, being asked to fudge the truth, which so many people are aware of doing in larger operations, even smaller operations. I had a former student of mine worked for me this summer at our hot dog stand. And because I taught this kid politics and government and organizing for social change, she was very challenging to me as an employee, saying, what is the price of these hot dogs really? And I'm like, Vanessa, this is a hot dog stand. This is not the big political statement. You know, back at the big house over there at the Heartland Cafe, that's where we do all the support. We're just selling hot dogs on the beach here. This is a little service we're doing. She said, I'm really concerned about our overhead. And, you know, and she reminded me of, I mean, our markup, that it was too, that it might be too much gouging for the hot dog. $1.50 for a hot dog. But she reminded me of me. I remember when I was in college. It was 1970 when the strike happened. Myself and two roommates actually at that point had a shared job because none of us could work six nights a week till 4 a.m. at this crummy fast food joint near our school. So we went to the guy and said, the three of us will take that job if you don't mind. One of us will be here every night. And so we did that. When the strike happened, because we had been serving junk, I mean mega junk, and Pepsi and everything else, you know, we went to him and very principled sat there and said, we can no longer in good conscience serve Pepsi and Coca-Cola products, because do you know what they're doing in Vietnam, and do you know what they, you know, and the guy, I don't know how he managed to keep a straight face, you know, as he said, yeah, well, I'm really sorry to lose you guys, goodbye, you know. So, you know, the other issues that we didn't touch on the other day, but that I the honesty question is one, and also whether or not you're encouraged to let your own gifts bloom, you know, and we can juxtapose that with if people feel like if the power structure that they're sort of beholden to in their job or needing to answer to in their job are blamed for something, step back from that a little bit, because I am the power structure, for example, at my job, and I often don't feel like my gifts can bloom because I just have too many fires to put out or plates to keep spinning. And I think that that's true for a lot of folks, whether or not they own their own business or not. And so to the extent that we might find ourselves complaining at the end of a day, I really think that we should listen to our complaints, but also get right to them and out the other side. What are we really? Is it really so much? Is it in fact that I don't get to do everything I want to do, or is it really just diminishing your spirit to go to work every day, and you're not feeding your spirit enough somehow? One of those books, the one that have the articles that are transforming your work, and the recommitment one, Lewis Richard, has scads of like crazy little exercises to do at work. I mean, really very, actually they sound a little goofy, but I've tried a few of them. And for people in a situation where you do not have all the control you might want about how the day and the processes, to take a moment, whether it's on the elevated train, going to work, or even driving in your car, to take time before you automatically do the thing of, I turn it on, the radio's immediately on to NPR, I'm in, you know, I'm focused, I've got the commuter cup full of coffee, and I'm for bear. You know, to alter that, to say, I don't know, maybe it's too radical to say, skip the coffee, especially since I've been here, I've drank more coffee than I ever do at home, but, or skip the radio, more importantly. Stop for a second, for a minute, before you even pull out, and don't have the radio on, and really pretend like you've been there for 10 minutes and you're already into a high level of Zen meditation, and just slip into it. No sound, no motor running, yes, and appreciate that silence, and it's your only moment. And gather your strength, and there's lots and lots of great ideas, really, for dealing with real specific issues that you have with a boss or with a coworker, and sort of stepping back and coming at it from a different consciousness. Really allowing yourself to like undo some sort of boogeyman that has developed around your workplace, whether it's about a person or an idea or a type of work, and amazingly effective exercises, just on a one-shot deal kind of thing. Okay, and the other thing that we could remember to talk about is the notion of good work versus money, and can we do well and do good at the same time? I think nurses can, probably, because we need you so badly at this time. But I also think that, you know, the whole HMO and the healthcare system in general, as seen by us non-professionals who you have to use it, it's just one of the scariest pieces of corporate bureaucracy, you know, ever imagined. I mean, you get a letter back from even an outfit like Blue Cross Blue Shield, which I still am under in a COBRA type situation, and I'm always afraid they're going to say, you know, denied, benefits denied, for who knows what reason. And then you have those incredible costs that healthcare is,
Well, in Wenatchee area, I think there's one, we had groups in and they just left. I mean, they just have said, okay, sorry, we're leaving.
You mean insurance
office? Yeah.
In Washington, all of the small communities in the entire state, a lot of
not covered.
Pulled out.
Yeah. People just left high and dry.
Yeah.
They don't, it's not whether or not you're covered, you're just plain, it's not even a question.
That would be a tough outfit to be dealing with. Mm-hmm. How do you guys do that? I mean, you gals. You don't have to, maybe some of the time.
I personally have another, I float. I go to all the different units. And so there are a lot of, you're right, ethical issues. That, you know, people are highly sick these days, and transplants and very tiny premature babies. And, you know, where do you draw the line? And I sort of drift around that. You know, I take care of those patients for the night, and then I go to another unit, which for me, I mean, I miss belonging, but I kind of belong to the whole system. But I never really end up having to follow anything through.
Huh.
And so that, I think, has helped me out, because I, you know, you can kind of, we all deal with patients that you think, like she's describing, you know, just let them go, you know, and they kind of go tiptoeing in with this treatment, well, one thing leads to another, well, you know, and they're, some people have an amazingly strong will to want to live, too. Mm-hmm. So anything that's dangled out there, they'll try it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I feel like, personally, at the university, I feel like the nurses have a lot of say. I have really felt like the nurses are well respected, and the doctors, depending on the particular group. But most of the time, they'll just let us make decisions about how we go about caring for somebody, and a lot of, say, internal care and dealing with the families, and you know, so I feel like nurses have quite a bit of clout, actually. Maybe not in some small private hospitals, but my only last 25 years has been at the U, and I feel like nurses are very respected around there. And so anyway, I you know,
it was well you should be. But so you don't really have to, you know, you might run into these possible causes of ethical questioning, but you don't have to stay around long enough. As you said, you basically skirt around that soon enough.
But I know it's an issue for a lot of other people. I mean, just
other professionals.
You know, other nurses who stay in the same units, like transplants or in the preemies. That's a real area. That's a hard one. And
it is.
You know, well, yeah, because you know what. You know, you...
Because they're staying alive that would not have survived birth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a mentality that healthcare can and will cure everything. I mean, I don't know if you feel that, but it's like you're expected to do more and more. Yeah. There's a fear of death, and we don't face it in our country.
Right, no.
We do everything to avoid it.
Right.
Everything we do.
Right.
And people expect everything.
Yeah, they come.
They
do.
Want it. Everything. Yeah.
And even for people, I mean, one case scenario, we had a patient, elderly, emphysema. She knew she'd been resuscitated once and had had the breathing.
Go ahead, use the technical terms. Well, what we are.
Yeah, respirator. She's intubated for a while, and when she finally, after a long period, got off of it, they said, if this ever happens again, you probably won't get off this machine. So she went out and filled out, you know, all the information about how she wanted this not to be done. She did not want to be resuscitated
right.
at the time.
Right.
And doctors in her area knew that. Well, the event came up again because she was basically in a terminal process over time. Family panicked. No, family did not panic. Family said, do not. Doctors panicked. Because there's a legal thing here going, too. And they're afraid of lawsuit.
But if she has written out...
They can't. A paper. I've been told by
what do they call that? A will. A living will.
Yeah,
my mother wrote one of those.
Yeah.
And gave it all. Gave it all.
It's been said that...
That's not enough.
They may not have really understood what they signed. So it's very scary. And so the doctors did what they felt like they had to do.
Out of fear.
It is tough to watch a patient die.
Yeah.
I mean, if you know there might be something. But that person spent a year on the respirator in one state, and then they moved her over to where we were in another state. She was with us in the medical intensive care, trying to extubate herself daily. I mean, every shift, trying to do it herself. And we were held responsible to put it back in place.
Oh my.
For 1 year. Two years on a respirator.
Whoa.
That is just a wild story. But
that's
that is
high
the case
drama.
Of, that's the ethical issues that finally wiped me out. Because it was a game. I mean, I wanted so badly to leave it off. But the alarms are going, well, what do you do? Well, you could unplug something. But that's taking life into my hands. I can't do that.
Right.
And so you're caught.
Intense.
That is a very life-draining thing for me. And yet that's what I'm driving. I'm driving into a whole new area. Is how can you help people live where they are? And work on the spiritual journey and not depend on somebody else to, you know, extend your life. But I guess it's more quality.
Quality before people get sick and leave.
Preventative care. And I guess I'm going all the way back to preventative care, spiritual. And that's where I got life was in the spiritual part of that. And where I got death was just the machinery, just flogging the dead horse. And it has to do with where I was working. I'm not an intensive care person, and that's just where I was for a while.
Yeah.
But it was a real eye-opening experience.
Did you work with Tom McCormick and all over at University Hospital?
This is in Iowa, University of Iowa.
He's on he teaches for medical ethics at University Hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. In Washington, right?
University of Washington.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're done?
I don't know of him, but I work nights and I float, so
He's in the medical school, yeah. He teaches medical ethics at University of Washington.
Work ethics can just be such a subtle thing. I mean, that's really blatant.
Right.
Yeah. But when I was applying for jobs, there were jobs where I would think, well, this is what that company's all about. Oh, I just don't think I can do that. Or I would go to their website and I would read something and I would just think, I don't think, because when I left, I worked for a large insurance company, not health insurance, car and casualty, mm-hmm. and life, but no health insurance. And otherwise,
insurance is also a tricky field.
Yeah, and I got to the point, I never felt wonderful about something. I mean, people have to have insurance, that's true, but I just thought, you know, you work for a financial organization, basically. Mm-hmm. But as time went by, you know, I worked for Safeco insurance companies. And when they bought Safeco Field, I just started thinking, what are they all about? What's this company all about? And then the last couple of years I was there, I had to work with some very high-up people in a company, in the marketing department. And it was the first time I went to my boss, and I was just sick, almost ill. You know, you get that bad feeling in your stomach. And I said, you know, I mean, this is somebody who is lying, you know, blatantly lying. And I said, this is the first time I've been at work. And I just started coming to work in the morning. I just thought, I don't belong here.
Yeah.
I don't belong here anymore. And I knew I had to leave. I just.
How long did you go with that feeling before you quit?
About, I wrote probably not even a month. When I started feeling bad about the kind of people and seeing what positions they held in the company, I remember going home and I got this Woody Allen movie. I don't remember what it was, but I mean, I never even watched Woody Allen. I watched it before that weekend. My daughter came and she goes, Mom,
what are you doing?
Watching that Woody Allen movie again? And I said, and she knew I was just trying to, I was just like, how to go to this other place. It
right.
was and
you were anesthetizing yourself. Some people do drugs. It's not bad to do Woody Allen.
So she said, why haven't you written your resignation?
Good
girl. I go home from work the next day and she'd say, Mom, did you write that letter?
Oh, see, that's good.
And I took this in college, and I called both my other daughter. I said, you know, if I quit, I'll be out of work. And my kids were just going, quit, quit, quit. And then I went home one night. I was at work one day, and some things were going on. And I went home, and I sat down, and I thought, either I'm going to write this proposal, or I'm going to write my letter of resignation. And I did both.
Oh, by very midnight, good.
I had them both done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very good.
So, you know, but that whole thing of business ethics and what is the organization about? And I mean, I think it's wonderful. I really envy everybody here. It feels like they're in this seamless thing.
Well, there's bumps along the way. Yeah. I mean, Renee, I'm sure that the church hasn't proven an ivory palace of wonderful guys and gals to.
Well, Renee was actually one of the people who was very encouraging.
Yeah.
My job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's.
Yeah, you know, all kinds of.
But Renee was doing her work before it was her job, and that's a very, that's a very unique and wonderful place to be. You're, you know.
But you know, the church is not a perfect place.
No.
It's made up of sinners, you know. And it's the same on staff, you know. People make mistakes.
Sure. Exactly.
You know, and sometimes in people, I've seen people do things. I've seen people lie. I've seen people do things out of because they're threatened by somebody else's skills.
Mm-hmm.
All the same kind of things that you see in wherever exist in the church too.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, we try to we try not to let those things happen, you know, and work on a staff, but things happen.
Mm-hmm. Honesty is a pretty rare commodity out there in the work world. Mm-hmm. People are very afraid of honesty. It's sort of, there's either little or larger constructs against people having to be really, truly face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball honest. And that's the scary thing to me, someone who's just sort of out there.
You know, we're all sort of driven by a sense of survival, you know?
So what does that mean then?
Well, some people do things and say things when you're talking about honesty.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people are faced with, do I tell the truth here or live in this honest way and lose my job?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And none of it is an easy thing, that's for sure.
No.
And I think the church is probably, I first started working in the church years and years ago, I thought, well, where could there be a better place? And yet I've seen people who you thought were your best friend stabbed in the back.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Because they were threatened.
The academic world is another place like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've taught college for the last 24 years, and it can get very ugly very quickly.
Yeah.
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 So, you know, basically, I really look into this subject because, and I also thought this would be a good setting for it since we all do it. A little bit of dishwashing, a little bit of whatever we volunteer to do while we're around Holden, and everybody around us doing the major work that supports our being here is doing it out of a volunteer basis, that it would be a good place to look at the natural needs of human beings to actually have their work serve them as well as the community, and can that happen at the same time? And I, you know, that what I find whenever I talk to people, listen to folks about work, is that there's really not enough support for people to develop their work for themselves, as well as how it would better serve whatever its stated purpose can be. I mean that the hierarchy in certain corporations ignore the fact that the people actually with contact with the customers might have something to offer about how that contact could be better, improved, you know, made more efficient. Corporations have come a long way with this stuff for a while, but it's still and can go back at any time. Mm-hmm. You know, Saturn was an outfit that started on teamwork, big time teamwork concept, and you probably saw their commercials where regular folks were doing extraordinary jobs of getting people their cars. Well, the last thing I read about Saturn about a month ago, vis-a-vis the work experience, is that some of the workers were getting a little tired of the quote-unquote teamwork thing, and were looking back at seeing how much closer they could return to the union contract that they had had with UAW before. So nothing stays the same. I would just love to support you who came here today with any of these readings, and also to let you know, show you the books that I brought. Tomorrow's class, the last session I'm doing, is at 9 in the morning. I don't know that anybody will be up and out, but anyway, tomorrow's session is the last one, and actually I was going to try and get people to do a meditative walk to Ten Mile Creek, it's just a mile away, and it's a nice walk, and if the class had been, or the sessions had been like they were the first couple of times, I know some of those folks who were there yesterday and the day before had not hiked yet. So I was going to use it as a way to say, all right, just stop with this feed your brain thing. We're going to walk to the do what we practice, what we preached here about contemplative, you know, restorative prayer about our work situation. And that may happen. I'll just see who shows up, but the, just to warn you, that might be something I try and pull. Yeah, actually, the labyrinth is, was the other thought I had. I have not been out there. Is it cool?
I've done a labyrinth before, and I like what they have out there, because it's very roomy.
Is it good enough to...
10 minutes to walk in.
Really?
At a moderate pace. Not fast, not fast.
Where is that?
Well, that would be something I'd totally be open to.
Yeah, it's pretty
cool. Have you all experienced the labyrinth?
No, I'm sure you have.
Yes? Mm-hmm.
No, I've seen it. I saw it today, but didn't go into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it built up? I thought it was just some rocks on the ground or something.
It's a little path.
It's just a path.
Yeah, I went out to it, but just didn't go.